years he was a fierce, sour, angry bankrupt, without a kind word or a kind look for anyone. He had been so different, Fitz Jarndyce. He was drawn to a debtor's prison. There he died. Then our brother was drawn swiftly to drunkenness and rags and death. Then my sister was drawn, hush, never ask to what. Then I was ill and in misery, and heard, as I had often heard before, that this was all the work of Chancery. When I got better, I went to look at the monster, and then I found out how it was, and I was drawn to stay there. Having got over her own short narrative, in the delivery of which she had spoken in a low, strained voice, as if the shock were fresh upon her, she gradually resumed her usual air of amiable importance. "You don't quite credit me, my dear. Well, well, you will some day. I am a little rambling, but I have noticed. I have seen many new faces come, unsuspicious, within the influence of the mace and seal in these many years, as my father's came there, as my brother's, as my sister's, as my own. I hear Conversation Kenge and the rest of them say to the new faces, 'Here's Little Miss Flight. Oh, you're new here, and you must come and be presented to Little Miss Flight. Very good. Proud, I'm sure, to have the honour.' And we all laugh. But Fitz Jarndyce, I know what will happen. I know far better than they do when the attraction has begun. I know the signs, my dear. I saw them beginning, Gridley, and I saw them end. Fitz Jarndyce, my love," speaking low again, "I saw them beginning in our friend, the ward in Jarndyce. Let someone hold him back, or he'll be drawn to ruin." She looked at me in silence for some moments, with her face gradually softening into a smile, seeming to fear that she had been too gloomy, and seeming also to lose the connection in her mind. She said politely, as she sipped her glass of wine, "Yes, my dear, as I was saying, I expect a judgment, shortly. Then I shall release my birds, you know, and confer estates." I was much impressed by her allusion to Richard, and by the sad meaning, so sadly illustrated in her poor pinched form, that made its way through all her incoherence. But happily for her, she was quite complacent again now, and beamed with nods and smiles. "But, my dear," she said gaily, reaching another hand to put it upon mine, "you have not congratulated me on my physician, positively not once yet." I was obliged to confess that I did not quite know what she meant. "My physician, Mr. Woodcourt, my dear, who was so exceedingly attentive to me, though his services were rendered quite gratuitously, until the day of judgment. I mean, the judgment that will dissolve the spell upon me of the mace and seal." "Mr. Woodcourt is so far away now," said I, "that I thought the time for such congratulation was past, Miss Flight."
"But, my child," she returned, "is it possible that you don't know what has happened?"
"No," said I.
"Not what everybody has been talking of, my beloved Fitz Jarndyce?"
"No," said I. "You forget how long I've been here."
"True. My dear, for the moment, true. I blame myself, but my memory has been drawn out of me, with everything else, by what I mentioned. Very strong influence, is it not? Well, my dear, there has been a terrible shipwreck over in those East Indian seas."
"Mr. Woodcourt shipwrecked?"
"Don't be agitated, my dear. He is safe. An awful scene, death in all shapes. Hundreds of dead and dying, fire, storm, and darkness. Numbers of the drowning thrown upon a rock. There and through it all, my dear physician was a hero, calm and brave through everything. Saved many lives, never complained in hunger and thirst, wrapped naked people in his spare clothes. Took the lead, showed them what to do, governed them, tended the sick, buried the dead, and brought the poor survivors safely off at last. My dear, the poor emaciated creatures all but worshipped him. They fell down at his feet when they got to the land and blessed him. The whole country rings with it. Stay, where's my bag of documents? I've got it there, and you shall read it, you shall read it."
And I did read all the noble history, though very slowly and imperfectly then, for my eyes were so dimmed that I could not see the words, and I cried so much that I was many times obliged to lay down the long account she had cut out of the newspaper. I felt so triumphant ever to have known the man who had done such generous and gallant deeds. I felt such glowing exultation in his renown. I so admired and loved what he had done that I envied the storm-worn people who had fallen at his feet and blessed him as their preserver. I could myself have kneeled down then, so far away, and blessed him in my rapture that he should be so truly good and brave. I felt that no one, mother, sister, wife, could honour him more than I. I did, indeed. My poor little visitor made me a present of the account, and when, as the evening began to close in, she rose to take her leave, lest she should miss the coach by which she was to return, She was still full of the shipwreck, which I had not yet sufficiently composed myself to understand in all its details. "My dear," said she, as she carefully folded up her scarf and gloves, "my brave physician ought to have a title bestowed upon him. No doubt he will. You are of that opinion?"
That he well deserved one, yes. That he would ever have one, no.
"Why not, Fitz Jarndyce?" she asked rather sharply. I said it was not the custom in England to confer titles on men distinguished by peaceful services, however good and great, unless occasionally when they consisted of the accumulation of some very large amount of money.
"Why, good gracious," said Miss Flite, "how can you say that? Surely you know, my dear, that all the greatest ornaments in England in knowledge, imagination, active humanity, and improvement of every sort are added to its nobility. Look round you, my dear, and consider. You must be rambling a little now, I think, if you don't know that this is the great reason why titles will always last in the land."
I am afraid she believed what she said, for there were moments when she was very mad indeed. And now I must part with a little secret I have thus far tried to keep. I had thought sometimes that Mr. Woodcourt loved me, and that if he had been richer he would perhaps have told me that he loved me before he went away. I had thought sometimes that if he had done so, I should have been glad of it. But how much better it was now that this had never happened. What should I have suffered if I had had to write to him and tell him that the poor face he had known as mine was quite gone from me, and that I freely released him from his bondage to one whom he had never seen? Oh, it was so much better as it was. With a great pang mercifully spared me, I could take back to my heart my childish prayer to be all he had so brightly shown himself, and there was nothing to be undone. No chain for me to break, or for him to drag, and I could go, please God, my lowly way along the path of duty, and he could go his nobler way upon its broader road. And though we were apart upon the journey, I might aspire to meet him, unselfishly, innocently, better far than he had thought of me when I found some favour in his eyes, at the journey's end.
Chapter 36. Chesney Wold.
Charlie and I did not set off alone upon our expedition into Lincolnshire. My guardian had made up his mind not to lose sight of me until I was safe in Mr. Boythorn's house. So he accompanied us, and we were 2 days upon the road. I found every breath of air, and every scent, and every flower and leaf, and blade of grass, and every passing cloud, and everything in nature more beautiful and wonderful to me than I had ever found it yet. This was my first gain from my illness. How little I had lost when the wide world was so full of delight for me. My guardian intending to go back immediately, we appointed, on our way down, a day when my dear girl should come. I wrote her a letter of which he took charge, and he left us within half an hour of our arrival at our destination on a delightful evening in the early summertime. If a good fairy had built the house for me with a wave of her wand, and I had been a princess and her favoured godchild, I could not have been more considered in it. So many preparations were made for me, and such an endearing remembrance was shown of all my little tastes and likings, that I could have sat down, overcome, a dozen times before I had revisited half the rooms. I did better than that, however, by showing them all to Charlie instead. Charlie's delight calmed mine, and after we had had a walk in the garden, and Charlie had exhausted her whole vocabulary of admiring expressions, I was as tranquilly happy as I ought to have been. It was a great comfort to be able to say to myself after tea, "Esther, my dear, I think you are quite sensible enough to sit down now and write a note of thanks to your host." He had left a note of welcome for me, as sunny as his own face, and had confided his bird to my care, which I knew to be his highest mark of confidence. Accordingly, I wrote a little note to him in London, telling him how all his favourite plants and trees were looking, and how the most astonishing of birds had chirped the honours of the house to me in the most hospitable manner, and how, after singing on my shoulder to the inconceivable rapture of my little maid, he was then at roost in the usual corner of his cage, but whether dreaming or no I could not report. My note finished and sent off to the post, I made myself very busy in unpacking and arranging, and I sent Charlie to bed in good time, and told her I should want her no more that night. For I had not yet looked in the glass, and had never asked to have my own restored to me. I knew this to be a weakness which must be overcome, but I had always said to myself that I would begin afresh when I got to where I now was. Therefore I had wanted to be alone. And therefore I said, now alone, in my own room, "Esther, if you are to be happy, If you are to have any right to pray to be true-hearted, you must keep your word, my dear." I was quite resolved to keep it, but I sat down for a little while first to reflect upon all my blessings, and then I said my prayers and thought a little more. My hair had not been cut off, though it had been in danger more than once. It was long and thick. I let it down and shook it out, and went up to the glass upon the dressing-table. There was a little muslin curtain drawn across it. I drew it back and stood for a moment looking through such a veil of my own hair that I could see nothing else. Then I put my hair aside and looked at the reflection in the mirror, encouraged by seeing how placidly it looked at me. I was very much changed. Oh, very, very much. At first my face was so strange to me that I think I should have put my hands before it and started back but for the encouragement I have mentioned. Very soon it became more familiar, and then I knew the extent of the alteration in it better than I had done at first. It was not like what I had expected, but I had expected nothing definite, and I dare say anything definite would have surprised me. I had never been a beauty, and had never thought myself one, but I had been very different from this. It was all gone now. Heaven was so good to me that I could let it go with a few not bitter tears, and could stand there arranging my hair for the night quite thankfully. One thing troubled me, and I considered it for a long time before I went to sleep. I had kept Mr. Woodcourt's flowers. When they were withered, I had dried them and put them in a book that I was fond of. Nobody knew this, not even Ada. I was doubtful whether I had a right to preserve what he had sent to one so different, whether it was generous towards him to do it. I wished to be generous to him, even in the secret depths of my heart, which he would never know, because I could have loved him, could have been devoted to him. At last I came to the conclusion that I might keep them if I treasured them only as a remembrance of what was irrevocably past and gone, never to be looked back on any more in any other light. I hope this may not seem trivial. I was very much in earnest. I took care to be up early in the morning, and to be before the glass when Charlie came in on tiptoe. "Dear, dear, miss," cried Charlie, starting. "Is that you?" "Yes, Charlie," said I, quietly putting up my hair, "and I am very well indeed, and very happy." I saw it was a weight off Charlie's mind, but it was a greater weight off mine. I knew the worst now, and was composed to it. I shall not conceal, as I go on, the weaknesses I could not quite conquer, but they always passed from me soon, and the happier frame of mind stayed by me faithfully. Wishing to be fully re-established in my strength and my good spirits before Ada came, I now laid down a little series of plans with Charlie for being in the fresh air all day long. We were to be out before breakfast, and were to dine early, and were to be out again before and after dinner, and were to talk in the garden after tea, and were to go to rest betimes, and were to climb every hill, and explore every road, lane, and field in the neighbourhood. As to restoratives and strengthening delicacies, Mr. Boythorn's good housekeeper was for ever trotting about with something to eat or drink in her hand. I could not even be heard of as resting in the park, but she would come trotting after me with a basket, her cheerful face shining with a lecture on the importance of frequent nourishment. Then there was a pony expressly for my riding, a chubby pony with a short neck and a mane all over his eyes, who could canter, when he would, so easily and quietly that he was a treasure. In a very few days he would come to me in the paddock when I called him, and eat out of my hand, and follow me about. We arrived at such a capital understanding that when he was jogging with me lazily and rather obstinately down some shady lane, if I patted his neck and said, "Stubbs, I'm surprised you don't canter when you know how much I like it, and I think you might oblige me, for you are only getting stupid and going to sleep," he would give his head a comical shake or two and set off directly, while Charlie would stand still and laugh with such enjoyment that her laughter was like music. I don't know who had given Stubbs his name, but it seemed to belong to him as naturally as his rough coat. Once we put him in a little chaise and drove him triumphantly through the green lanes for 5 miles. But all at once, as we were extolling him to the skies, he seemed to take it ill that he should have been accompanied so far by the circle of tantalizing little gnats that had been hovering round and round his ears the whole way, without appearing to advance an inch, and stopped to think about it. I suppose he came to the decision that it was not to be borne, for he steadily refused to move until I gave the reins to Charlie, and got out and walked, when he followed me with a sturdy sort of good humour, putting his head under my arm and rubbing his ear against my sleeve. It was in vain for me to say, "Now, Stubbs, I feel quite sure from what I know of you that you will go on if I ride a little while." For the moment I left him, he stood stock still again. Consequently, I was obliged to lead the way as before, and in this order we returned home, to the great delight of the village. Charlie and I had reason to call it the most friendly of villages, I am sure, for in a week's time the people were so glad to see us go by, though ever so frequently in the course of a day, that there were faces of greeting in every cottage. I had known many of the grown people before, and almost all the children, but now the very steeple began to wear a familiar and affectionate look. Among my new friends was an old, old woman who lived in such a little thatched and whitewashed dwelling that when the outside shutter was turned up on its hinges, it shut up the whole house front. This old lady had a grandson who was a sailor, and I wrote a letter to him for her, and drew at the top of it the chimney corner in which she had brought him up, and where his old stool yet occupied its old place. This was considered by the whole village the most wonderful achievement in the world. But when an answer came back all the way from Plymouth, in which he mentioned that he was going to take the picture all the way to America, and from America would write again, I got all the credit that ought to have been given to the post office, and was invested with the merit of the whole system. Thus, what with being so much in the air, playing with so many children, gossiping with so many people, sitting on invitation in so many cottages, going on with Charlie's education, and writing long letters to Ada every day, I had scarcely any time to think about that little loss of mine, and was almost always cheerful. If I did think of it at odd moments now and then, I had only to be busy and forget it. I felt it more than I had hoped I should once, when a child said, "Mother, why is the lady not a pretty lady now, like she used to be?" But when I found the child was not less fond of me, and drew its soft hand over my face with a kind of pitying protection in its touch, that soon set me up again. There were many little occurrences which suggested to me, with great consolation, how natural it is to gentle hearts to be considerate and delicate towards any inferiority. One of these particularly touched me. I happened to stroll into the little church when a marriage was just concluded, and the young couple had to sign the register. The bridegroom, to whom the pen was handed first, made a rude cross for his mark. The bride, who came next, did the same. Now I had known the bride when I was last there, not only as the prettiest girl in the place, but as having quite distinguished herself in the school, and I could not help looking at her with some surprise. She came aside and whispered to me, while tears of honest love and admiration stood in her bright eyes, "He's a dear good fellow, miss, but he can't write yet. He's going to learn of me, and I wouldn't shame him for the world." Why, what had I to fear, I thought, when there was this nobility in the soul of a labouring man's daughter? The air blew as freshly and revivingly upon me as it had ever blown, and the healthy colour came into my new face as it had come into my old one. Charlie was wonderful to see. She was so radiant and so rosy, and we both enjoyed the whole day and slept soundly the whole night. There was a favourite spot of mine in the park woods of Chesney Wold, where a seat had been erected commanding a lovely view. The wood had been cleared and opened to improve this point of sight, and the bright sunny landscape beyond was so beautiful that I rested there at least once every day. A picturesque part of the hall, called the Ghost's Walk, was seen to advantage from this higher ground, and the startling name and the old legend in the Dedlock family, which I had heard from Mr. Boythorn accounting for it, mingled with the view and gave it something of a mysterious interest, in addition to its real charms. There was a bank here, too, which was a famous one for violets, and as it was a daily delight of Charlie's to gather the wild flowers, she took as much to the spot as I did. It would be idle to inquire now why I never went close to the house, or never went inside it. The family were not there, I had heard on my arrival, and were not expected. I was far from being incurious or uninterested about the building. On the contrary, I often sat in this place, wondering how the rooms ranged, and whether any echo like a footstep really did resound at times, as the story said, upon the lonely Ghost's Walk. The indefinable feeling with which Lady Dedlock had impressed me may have had some influence in keeping me from the house even when she was absent. I'm not sure. Her face and figure were associated with it naturally, but I cannot say that they repelled me from it, though something did. For whatever reason or no reason, I had never once gone near it, down to the day at which my story now arrives. I was resting at my favourite point, after a long ramble, and Charlie was gathering violets at a little distance from me, I had been looking at the Ghost's Walk, lying in a deep shade of masonry afar off, and picturing to myself the female shape that was said to haunt it, when I became aware of a figure approaching through the wood. The perspective was so long and so darkened by leaves, and the shadows of the branches on the ground made it so much more intricate to the eye, that at first I could not discern what figure it was. By little and little it revealed itself to be a woman's, a lady's, Lady Dedlock's. She was alone and coming to where I sat with a much quicker step, I observed to my surprise, than was usual with her. I was flattered by her being unexpectedly so near. She was almost within speaking distance before I knew her, and would have risen to continue my walk, but I could not. I was rendered motionless, not so much by her hurried gesture of entreaty, not so much by her quick advance and outstretched hands, not so much by the great change in her manner and the absence of her haughty self-restraint, as by a something in her face that I had pined for and dreamed of when I was a little child. Something I had never seen in any face, something I had never seen in hers before. A dread and faintness fell upon me, and I called to Charlie. Lady Dedlock stopped upon the instant, and changed back almost to what I had known her. "Miss Summerson, I am afraid I have startled you," she said, now advancing slowly. "You can scarcely be strong yet. You have been very ill, I know. I have been much concerned to hear it." I could no more have removed my eyes from her pale face than I could have stirred from the bench on which I sat. She gave me her hand, and its deadly coldness, so at variance with the enforced composure of her features, deepened the fascination that overpowered me. I cannot say what was in my whirling thoughts. "You are recovering again?" she asked kindly. "I was quite well but a moment ago, Lady Dedlock." "Is this your young attendant?"
"Yes."
"Will you send her on before, and walk towards your house with me?"
"Charlie," said I, "take your flowers home, and I will follow you directly."
Charlie, with her best curtsy, blushingly tied on her bonnet and went her way. When she was gone, Lady Dedlock sat down on the seat beside me. I cannot tell in any words what the state of my mind was when I saw in her hand my handkerchief, with which I had covered the dead baby. I looked at her, but I could not see her. I could not hear her. I could not draw my breath. The beating of my heart was so violent and wild that I felt as if my life were breaking from me. But when she caught me to her breast, kissed me, wept over me, compassionated me, and called me back to myself, when she fell down on her knees and cried to me, "Oh, my child, I am your wicked and unhappy mother. Oh, try to forgive me." When I saw her at my feet on the bare earth in her great agony of mind, I felt, through all my tumult of emotion, a burst of gratitude to the providence of God that I was so changed as that I never could disgrace her by any trace of likeness, as that nobody could ever now look at me and look at her, and remotely think of any near tie between us. I raised my mother up, praying and beseeching her not to stoop before me in such affliction and humiliation. I did so in broken, incoherent words, for besides the trouble I was in, it frightened me to see her at my feet. I told her, or I tried to tell her, that if it were for me, her child, under any circumstances, to take upon me to forgive her, I did it, and had done it many, many years. I told her that my heart overflowed with love for her, that it was natural love which nothing in the past had changed or could change, that it was not for me, then resting for the first time on my mother's bosom, to take her to account for having given me life, but that my duty was to bless her and receive her, though the whole world turned from her, and that I only asked her leave to do it. I held my mother in my embrace, and she held me in hers. And among the still woods, in the silence of the summer day, there seemed to be nothing but our two troubled minds that was not at peace.
"To bless and receive me," groaned my mother, "it is far too late. I must travel my dark road alone, and it will lead me where it will. From day to day, sometimes from hour to hour, I do not see the way before my guilty feet. This is the earthly punishment I have brought upon myself. I bear it, and I hide it."
Even in the thinking of her endurance, she drew her habitual air of proud indifference about her like a veil, though she soon cast it off again.
"I must keep this secret, if by any means it can be kept, not wholly for myself. I have a husband, wretched and dishonouring creature that I am.
These words she uttered with a suppressed cry of despair, more terrible in its sound than any shriek. Covering her face with her hands, she shrank down in my embrace as if she were unwilling that I should touch her. Nor could I, by my utmost persuasions, or by any endearments I could use, prevail upon her to rise. She said, "No, no, no, she could only speak to me so. She must be proud and disdainful everywhere else. She would be humbled and ashamed there in the only natural moments of her life." My unhappy mother told me that in my illness she had been nearly frantic. She had but then known that her child was living. She could not have suspected me to be that child before. She had followed me down here to speak to me but once in all her life. We never could associate, never could communicate, never, probably from that time forth, could interchange another word on earth. She put into my hands a letter she had written for my reading only, and said when I had read it and destroyed it, but not so much for her sake, since she asked nothing, as for her husband's and my own, I must evermore consider her as dead. If I could believe that she loved me, in this agony in which I saw her, with a mother's love, she asked me to do that, for then I might think of her with a greater pity, imagining what she suffered. She had put herself beyond all hope and beyond all help. Whether she preserved her secret until death, or it came to be discovered, and she brought dishonour and disgrace upon the name she had taken, it was her solitary struggle always, and no affection could come near her, and no human creature could render her any aid. "But is the secret safe so far?" I asked. "Is it safe now, dearest mother?"
"No," replied my mother. "It has been very near discovery. It was saved by an accident. It may be lost by another accident tomorrow, any day."
"Do you dread a particular person?"
"Hush! Do not tremble and cry so much for me. I am not worthy of these tears," said my mother, kissing my hands. "I dread one person very much."
"An enemy?"
"Not a friend. One who is too passionless to be either. He is Sir Leicester Dedlock's lawyer, mechanically faithful without attachment, and very jealous of the profit, privilege, and reputation of being master of the mysteries of great houses."
"Has he any suspicions?"
"Many."
"Not of you," I said, alarmed.
"Yes. He is always vigilant and always near me. I may keep him at a standstill, but I can never shake him off."
"Has he so little pity or compunction?"
"He has none, and no anger. He is indifferent to everything but his calling. His calling is the acquisition of secrets, and the holding possession of such power as they give him, with no sharer or opponent in it."
"Could you trust in him?"
"I shall never try. The dark road I have trodden for so many years will end where it will. I follow it alone to the end, whatever the end may be. It may be near, it may be distant. While the road lasts, nothing turns me."
"Dear mother, are you so resolved?"
"I am resolved. I have long outbidden folly with folly, pride with pride, scorn with scorn, insolence with insolence, and have outlived many vanities with many more. I will outlive this danger, and outdie it, if I can. It has closed around me almost as awfully as if these woods of Chesney Wold had closed around the house. But my course through it is the same. I have but one. I can have but one."
"Mr. Jarndyce," I was beginning, when my mother hurriedly inquired,
"does he suspect?"
"No," said I. "No, indeed. Be assured that he does not."
And I told her what he had related to me as his knowledge of my story.
"But he is so good and sensible," said I, "that perhaps if he knew—"
My mother, who until this time had made no change in her position, raised her hand up to my lips and stopped me.
"Confide fully in him," she said after a little while. "You have my free consent, a small gift from such a mother to her injured child. But do not tell me of it. Some pride is left in me even yet."
I explained, as nearly as I could then, or can recall now, for my agitation and distress throughout were so great that I scarcely understood myself, though every word that was uttered in the mother's voice, so unfamiliar and so melancholy to me, which in my childhood I had never learned to love and recognize, had never been sung to sleep with, had never heard a blessing from, had never had a hope inspired by, made an enduring impression on my memory. I say I explained, or tried to do it, how I had only hoped that Mr. Jarndyce, who had been the best of fathers to me, might be able to afford some counsel and support to her. But my mother answered no. It was impossible. No one could help her. Through the desert that lay before her, she must go alone. My child, she said, for the last time. These kisses for the last time. These arms upon my neck for the last time. We shall meet no more. To hope to do what I seek to do, I must be what I have been so long. Such is my reward and doom. If you hear of Lady Dedlock, brilliant, prosperous, and flattered, think of your wretched mother, conscience-stricken underneath that mask. Think that the reality is in her suffering, in her useless remorse, in her murdering within her breast, the only love and truth of which it is capable. And then forgive her, if you can, and cry to heaven to forgive her, which it never can. We held one another for a little space yet, but she was so firm that she took my hands away and put them back against my breast, and with a last kiss, as she held them there, released them and went from me into the wood. I was alone, and calm and quiet below me in the sun and shade lay the old house, with its terraces and turrets, on which there had seemed to me to be such complete repose when I first saw it, but which now looked like the obdurate and unpitying watcher of my mother's misery. Stunned as I was, as weak and helpless at first as I had ever been in my sick chamber, the necessity of guarding against the danger of discovery, or even of the remotest suspicion, did me service. I took such precautions as I could to hide from Charlie that I had been crying, and I constrained myself to think of every sacred obligation that there was upon me to be careful and collected. It was not a little while before I could succeed, or could even restrain bursts of grief, but after an hour or so I was better, and felt that I might return. I went home very slowly and told Charlie, whom I found at the gate looking for me, that I had been tempted to extend my walk after Lady Dedlock had left me, and that I was overtired and would lie down. Safe in my own room, I read the letter. I clearly derived from it, and that was much then, that I had not been abandoned by my mother. Her elder and only sister, the godmother of my childhood, discovering signs of life in me when I had been laid aside as dead, had in her stern sense of duty, with no desire or willingness that I should live, reared me in rigid secrecy, and had never again beheld my mother's face from within a few hours of my birth. So strangely did I hold my place in this world, that until within a short time back I had never, to my own mother's knowledge, breathed, had been buried, had never been endowed with life, had never borne a name. When she had first seen me in the church, she had been startled, and had thought of what would have been like me if it had ever lived, and had lived on, but that was all then. What more the letter told me needs not to be repeated here. It has its own times and places in my story. My first care was to burn what my mother had written, and to consume even its ashes. I hope it may not appear very unnatural or bad in me that I then became heavily sorrowful to think I had ever been reared, that I felt as if I knew it would have been better and happier for many people if indeed I had never breathed, that I had a terror of myself as the danger and the possible disgrace of my own mother and of a proud family name, that I was so confused and shaken as to be possessed by a belief that it was right, and had been intended that I should die in my birth, and that it was wrong and not intended that I should be then alive. These are the real feelings that I had. I fell asleep worn out, and when I awoke, I cried afresh to think that I was back in the world with my load of trouble for others. I was more than ever frightened of myself, thinking anew of her against whom I was a witness, of the owner of Chesney Wold, of the new and terrible meaning of the old words now moaning in my ear like a surge upon the shore. Your mother, Esther, was your disgrace, and you are hers. The time will come, and soon enough, when you will understand this better, and will feel it too, as no one save a woman can. With them, those other words returned, pray daily that the sins of others be not visited upon your head. I could not disentangle all that was about me, and I felt as if the blame and the shame were all in me, and the visitation had come down. The day waned into a gloomy evening, overcast and sad, and I still contended with the same distress. I went out alone, and after walking a little in the park, watching the dark shades falling on the trees, and the fitful flight of the bats, which sometimes almost touched me, was attracted to the house for the first time. Perhaps I might not have gone near it, if I had been in a stronger frame of mind. As it was, I took the path that led close by it. I did not dare to linger or to look up, but I passed before the terrace garden with its fragrant odours, and its broad walks, and its well-kept beds and smooth turf, and I saw how beautiful and grave it was, and how the old stone balustrades and parapets and wide flights of shallow steps were seamed by time and weather, and how the trained moss and ivy grew about them, and around the old stone pedestal of the sundial. And I heard the fountain falling. Then the way went by long lines of dark windows, diversified by turreted towers and porches of eccentric shapes, where old stone lions and grotesque monsters bristled outside dens of shadow and snarled at the evening gloom over the escutcheons they held in their grip. Thence the path wound underneath a gateway, and through a courtyard where the principal entrance was, I hurried quickly on, and by the stables where none but deep voices seemed to be, whether in the murmuring of the wind through the strong mass of ivy holding to a high red wall, or in the low complaining of the weathercock, or in the barking of the dogs, or in the slow striking of a clock. So, encountering presently a sweet smell of limes, whose rustling I could hear, I turned with the turning of the path to the south front, and there above me were the balustrades of the Ghost's Walk, and one lighted window that might be my mother's. The way was paved here, like the terrace overhead, and my footsteps, from being noiseless, made an echoing sound upon the flags. Stopping to look at nothing, but seeing all I did see as I went, I was passing quickly on, and in a few moments should have passed the lighted window, when my echoing footsteps brought it suddenly into my mind that there was a dreadful truth in the legend of the Ghost's Walk, that it was I who was to bring calamity upon the stately house, and that my warning feet were haunting it even then. Seized with an augmented terror of myself, which turned me cold, I ran from myself and everything, retraced the way by which I had come, and never paused until I had gained the lodge gate, and the park lay sullen and black behind me. Not before I was alone in my own room for the night, and had again been dejected and unhappy there, did I begin to know how wrong and thankless this state was. But from my darling, who was coming on the morrow, I found a joyful letter, full of such loving anticipation that I must have been of marble if it had not moved me. From my guardian, too, I found another letter, asking me to tell Dame Durden, if I should see that little woman anywhere, that they had moped most pitiably without her, that the housekeeping was going to rack and ruin, that nobody else could manage the keys, and that everybody in and about the house declared it was not the same house, and was becoming rebellious for her return. Two such letters together made me think how far beyond my deserts I was beloved, and how happy I ought to be. That made me think of all my past life, and that brought me, as it ought to have done before, into a better condition. For I saw very well that I could not have been intended to die, or I should never have lived. Not to say should never have been reserved for such a happy life. I saw very well how many things had worked together for my welfare, and that if the sins of the fathers were sometimes visited upon the children, the phrase did not mean what I had in the morning feared it meant. I knew I was as innocent of my birth as a queen of hers, and that before my heavenly father I should not be punished for birth, nor a queen rewarded for it. I had had experience, in the shock of that very day, that I could, even thus soon, find comforting reconcilements to the change that had fallen on me. I renewed my resolutions, and prayed to be strengthened in them, pouring out my heart for myself and for my unhappy mother, and feeling that the darkness of the morning was passing away. It was not upon my sleep, and when the next day's light awoke me, it was gone. My dear girl was to arrive at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. How to help myself through the intermediate time better than by taking a long walk along the road by which she was to come, I did not know. So Charlie and I and Stubbs saddled, for we never drove him after the one great occasion, made a long expedition along that road and back. On our return, we held a great review of the house and garden, and saw that everything was in its prettiest condition, and had the bird out ready as an important part of the establishment. There were more than 2 full hours yet to elapse before she could come, and in that interval, which seemed a long one, I must confess I was nervously anxious about my altered looks. I loved my darling so well that I was more concerned for their effect on her than on anyone. I was not in this slight distress because I at all repined. I am quite certain I did not that day. But I thought, would she be wholly prepared? When she first saw me, might she not be a little shocked and disappointed? Might it not prove a little worse than she expected? Might she not look for her old Esther and not find her? Might she not have to grow used to me and to begin all over again? I knew the various expressions of my sweet girl's face so well, and it was such an honest face in its loveliness, that I was sure beforehand she could not hide that first look from me. And I considered whether, if it should signify any one of these meanings, which was so very likely, could I quite answer for myself. Well, I thought I could. After last night I thought I could. But to wait, and expect, and think, with such bad preparation that I resolved to go along the road again and meet her. So I said to Charlie, "Charlie, I will go by myself and walk along the road until she comes." Charlie, highly approving of anything that pleased me, I went and left her at home. But before I got to the second milestone, I had been in so many palpitations from seeing dust in the distance, though I knew it was not and could not be the coach yet, that I resolved to turn back and go home again. And when I had turned, I was in such fear of the coach coming up behind me, though I still knew that it neither would nor could do any such thing, that I ran the greater part of the way to avoid being overtaken. Then I considered, when I had got safe back again, this was a nice thing to have done. Now I was hot, and had made the worst of it, instead of the best. At last, when I believed there was at least a quarter of an hour more yet, Charlie all at once cried out to me as I was trembling in the garden, "Here she comes, miss, here she is!" I did not mean to do it, but I ran upstairs into my room, and hid myself behind the door. There I stood trembling, even when I heard my darling calling as she came upstairs, "Esther, my dear, my love, where are you? Little woman, dear Dame Durden?" She ran in, and was running out again when she saw me. Ah, my angel girl! The old dear look! All love, all fondness, all affection! Nothing else in it. No, nothing. Nothing. Oh, how happy I was, down upon the floor, with my sweet, beautiful girl down upon the floor too, holding my scarred face to her lovely cheek, bathing it with tears and kisses, rocking me to and fro like a child, calling me by every tender name that she could think of, and pressing me to her faithful heart.
Chapter 37. Jaundice and Jaundice. If the secret I had to keep had been mine, I must have confided it to Ada before we had been long together. But it was not mine, and I did not feel that I had a right to tell it, even to my guardian, unless some great emergency arose. It was a weight to bear alone. Still my present duty appeared to be plain, and blessed in the attachment of my dear, I did not want an impulse and encouragement to do it. Though often when she was asleep and all was quiet, the remembrance of my mother kept me waking and made the night sorrowful. I did not yield to it at another time, and Ada found me what I used to be, except, of course, in that particular of which I have said enough, and which I have no intention of mentioning any more just now, if I can help it. The difficulty that I felt in being quite composed that first evening, when Ada asked me, over our work, if the family were at the house, and when I was obliged to answer yes, I believed so, for Lady Dedlock had spoken to me in the woods the day before yesterday, was great. Greater still when Ada asked me what she had said, and when I replied that she had been kind and interested, and when Ada, while admitting her beauty and elegance, remarked upon her proud manner and her imperious, chilling air. But Charlie helped me through, unconsciously, by telling us that Lady Dedlock had only stayed at the house two nights on her way from London to visit at some other great house in the next county, and that she had left early on the morning after we had seen her at our view, as we called it. Charlie verified the adage about little pitchers, I am sure, for she heard of more sayings and doings in a day than would have come to my ears in a month. We were to stay a month at Mr. Boythorn's. My pet had scarcely been there a bright week, as I recollect the time, when one evening, after we had finished helping the gardener in watering his flowers, and just as the candles were lighted, Charlie appeared with a very important air behind Ada's chair, beckoned me mysteriously out of the room.
"Oh, if you please, miss," said Charlie in a whisper, with her eyes at their roundest and largest, "you're wanted at the Dedlock Arms."
"Why, Charlie," said I, "who can possibly want me at the public house?"
"I don't know, miss," returned Charlie,
putting her head forward and folding her hands tight upon the band of her little apron, which she always did in the enjoyment of anything mysterious or confidential.
"But it's a gentleman, miss, and his compliments, and will you please to come without saying anything about it?"
"Whose compliments, Charlie?"
"His'n, miss," returned Charlie,
whose grammatical education was advancing, but not very rapidly.
"And how do you come to be the messenger, Charlie?" "I'm not a messenger, if you please, miss," returned my little maid. "It was W. Grubble, miss."
"And who is W. Grubble, Charlie?"
"Mr. Grubble, miss," returned Charlie. "Don't you know, miss? The Dedlock Arms by W. Grubble,"
which Charlie delivered as if she were slowly spelling out the sign.
"I? The landlord, Charlie?" "Yes, miss, if you please, miss. His wife is a beautiful woman, but she broke her ankle and it never joined. And her brother's the sawyer that was put in the cage, miss, and they expect he'll drink himself to death entirely on beer," said Charlie.
Not knowing what might be the matter, and being easily apprehensive now, I thought it best to go to this place by myself. I bade Charlie be quick with my bonnet and veil and my shawl, and having put them on, went away down the little hilly street, where I was as much at home as in Mr. Boythorn's garden. Mr. Grubble was standing in his shirt sleeves at the door of his very clean little tavern waiting for me. He lifted off his hat with both hands when he saw me coming, and carrying it so as if it were an iron vessel, it looked as heavy, preceded me along the sanded passage to his best parlour, a neat carpeted room with more plants in it than were quite convenient, a coloured print of Queen Caroline, several shells, a good many tea trays, two stuffed and dried fish in glass cases, and either a curious egg or a curious pumpkin, but I don't know which, and I doubt if many people did, hanging from his ceiling. I knew Mr. Grubble very well by sight from his often standing at his door. A pleasant-looking, stoutish, middle-aged man who never seemed to consider himself cosily dressed for his own fireside without his hat and top-boots, but who never wore a coat except at church. He snuffed the candle, and backing away a little to see how it looked, backed out of the room, unexpectedly to me, for I was going to ask him by whom he had been sent. The door of the opposite parlour being then opened, I heard some voices, familiar in my ears, I thought, which stopped. A quick, light step approached the room in which I was, and who should stand before me but Richard. "My dear Esther," he said, "my best friend." And he really was so warm-hearted and earnest that in the first surprise and pleasure of his brotherly greeting I could scarcely find breath to tell him that Ada was well. "Answering my very thoughts, always the same dear girl," said Richard, leading me to a chair and seating himself beside me. I put my veil up, but not quite. "Always the same dear girl," said Richard, just as heartily as before. I put up my veil altogether, and laying my hand on Richard's sleeve and looking in his face, told him how much I thanked him for his kind welcome, and how greatly I rejoiced to see him, the more so because of the determination I had made in my illness, which I now conveyed to him. "My love," said Richard, "there is no one with whom I have a greater wish to talk than you, for I want you to understand me." "And I want you, Richard," said I, shaking my head, "to understand someone else."
"Since you refer so immediately to John Jarndyce," said Richard, "I suppose you mean him?"
"Of course I do."
"Then I may say at once that I am glad of it, because it is on that subject that I am anxious to be understood. By you, mind, you, my dear, I am not accountable to Mr. Jarndyce, or Mr. Anybody."
I was pained to find him taking this tone, and he observed it.
"Well, well, my dear," said Richard, "we won't go into that now. I want to appear quietly in your country house here, with you under my arm, and give my charming cousin a surprise. I suppose your loyalty to John Jarndyce will allow that?"
"My dear Richard," I returned, "you know you would be heartily welcome at his house, your home, if you will but consider it so, and you are as heartily welcome here."
"Spoken like the best of little women," cried Richard gaily.
I asked him how he liked his profession.
"Oh, I like it well enough," said Richard. "It's all right. It does as well as anything else for a time. I don't know that I shall care about it when I come to be settled, but I can sell out then, and, however, never mind all that botheration at present."
So young and handsome, and in all respects so perfectly the opposite of Miss Flight, and yet in the clouded, eager-seeking look that passed over him, so dreadfully like her.
"I am in town on leave just now," said Richard.
"Indeed?"
"Yes, I've run over to look after my chancery interests before the long vacation," said Richard, forcing a careless laugh. "We're beginning to spin along with that old suit at last, I promise you."
No wonder that I shook my head.
"As you say, it's not a pleasant subject."
Richard spoke with the same shade crossing his face as before.
"Let it go to the four winds for tonight. Puff, gone. Who do you suppose is with me? Was it Mr. Skimpole's voice I heard? That's the man. He does me more good than anybody. What a fascinating child it is. I asked Richard if anyone knew of their coming down together. He answered, no, nobody. He had been to call upon the dear old infant, so he called Mr. Skimpole, and the dear old infant had told him where we were, and he had told the dear old infant he was bent on coming to see us, and the dear old infant had directly wanted to come too, and so he had brought him. And he is worth, not to say his sordid expenses, but thrice his weight in gold, said Richard. He is such a cheery fellow, no worldliness about him, fresh and green-hearted. I certainly did not see the proof of Mr. Skimpole's unworldliness in his having his expenses paid by Richard, but I made no remark about that. Indeed, he came in and turned our conversation. He was charmed to see me, said he had been shedding delicious tears of joy and sympathy at intervals for 6 weeks on my account, had never been so happy as in hearing of my progress, began to understand the mixture of good and evil in the world now, felt that he appreciated health the more when somebody else was ill, didn't know but what it might be in the scheme of things that A should squint to make B happier in looking straight, or that C should carry a wooden leg to make D better satisfied with his flesh and blood in a silk stocking. "My dear Miss Summerson, here is our friend Richard," said Mr. Skimpole, "full of the brightest visions of the future which he evokes out of the darkness of Chancery. Now that's delightful. That's inspiriting. That's full of poetry. In old times the woods and solitudes were made joyous to the shepherd by the imaginary piping and dancing of Pan and the nymphs. This present shepherd, our pastoral Richard, brightens the dull inns of court by making Fortune and her train sport through them to the melodious notes of a judgment from the bench. That's very pleasant, you know. Some ill-conditioned, growling fellow may say to me, "What's the use of these legal and equitable abuses? How do you defend them?" I reply, "My growling friend, I don't defend them, but they are very agreeable to me. There is a shepherd youth, a friend of mine, who transmutes them into something highly fascinating to my simplicity. I don't say it is for this that they exist, for I am a child among you worldly grumblers, and not called upon to account to you or myself for anything, but it may be so." I began seriously to think that Richard could scarcely have found a worse friend than this. It made me uneasy that at such a time when he most required some right principle and purpose, he should have this captivating looseness and putting off of everything, this airy dispensing with all principle and purpose, at his elbow. I thought I could understand how such a nature as my guardian's, experienced in the world, and forced to contemplate the miserable evasions and contentions of the family misfortune, found an immense relief in Mr. Skimpole's avowal of his weaknesses and display of guileless candour. But I could not satisfy myself that it was as artless as it seemed, or that it did not serve Mr. Skimpole's idle turn quite as well as any other part, and with less trouble. They both walked back with me, and Mr. Skimpole, leaving us at the gate, I walked softly in with Richard and said, "Ada, my love, I have brought a gentleman to visit you." It was not difficult to read the blushing, startled face. She loved him dearly, and he knew it, and I knew it. It was a very transparent business, that meeting as cousins only. I almost mistrusted myself as growing quite wicked in my suspicions, but I was not so sure that Richard loved her dearly. He admired her very much, anyone must have done that, and I dare say would have renewed their joyful engagement with great pride and ardour, but that he knew how she would respect her promise to my guardian. Still, I had a tormenting idea that the influence upon him extended even here, that he was postponing his best truth and earnestness in this, as in all things, until Jarndyce and Jarndyce should be off his mind. Ah me! What Richard would have been without that blight I never shall know now. He told Ada, in his most ingenuous way, that he had not come to make any secret inroad on the terms she had accepted, rather too implicitly and confidingly, he thought, from Mr. Jarndyce, that he had come openly to see her and to see me, and to justify himself for the present terms on which he stood with Mr. Jarndyce. As the dear old infant would be with us directly, he begged that I would make an appointment for the morning, when he might set himself right through the means of an unreserved conversation with me. I proposed to walk with him in the park at 7 o'clock, and this was arranged. Mr. Skimpole soon afterwards appeared, and made us merry for an hour. He particularly requested to see little Coavinses, meaning Charlie,
and told her with a patriarchal air that he had given her late father all the business in his power, and that if one of her little brothers would make haste to get set up in the same profession, he hoped he should still be able to put a good deal of employment in his way. "For I am constantly being taken in these nets," said Mr. Skimpole, looking beamingly at us over a glass of wine and water, "and am constantly being bailed out like a boat, or paid off like a ship's company. Somebody always does it for me. I can't do it, you know, for I never have any money, but somebody does it. I get out by somebody's means. I am not the starling. I get out. If you were to ask me who somebody is, upon my word I couldn't tell you. Let us drink to somebody. God bless him." Richard was a little late in the morning, but I had not to wait for him long, and we turned into the park. The air was bright and dewy, and the sky without a cloud. The birds sang delightfully. The sparkles in the fern, the grass and trees were exquisite to see. The richness of the woods seemed to have increased twentyfold since yesterday, as if, in the still night, when they had looked so massively hushed in sleep, nature, through all the minute details of every wonderful leaf, had been more wakeful than usual for the glory of that day. "This is a lovely place," said Richard, looking round. "None of the jar and discord of lawsuits here." But there was other trouble. "I tell you what, my dear girl," said Richard, "when I get affairs in general settled, I shall come down here, I think, and rest." "Would it not be better to rest now?" I asked. "Oh, as to resting now," said Richard, "or as to doing anything very definite now, that's not easy. In short, it can't be done. I can't do it, at least."
"Why not?" said I.
"You know why not, Esther. If you were living in an unfinished house, liable to have the roof put on or taken off, to be from top to bottom pulled down or built up, tomorrow, next day, next week, next month, next year, you would find it hard to rest or settle. So do I. Now? There's no now for us suitors."
I could almost have believed in the attraction on which my poor little wandering friend had expatiated when I saw again the darkened look of last night. Terrible to think it had in it also a shade of that unfortunate man who had died.
"My dear Richard," said I, "this is a bad beginning of our conversation."
"I knew you would tell me so, Dame Durden."
"And not I alone, dear Richard. It was not I who cautioned you once never to found a hope or expectation on the family curse."
"There you come back to John Jarndyce," said Richard impatiently. "Well, we must approach him sooner or later, for he is the staple of what I have to say, and it's as well at once. My dear Esther, how can you be so blind? Don't you see that he is an interested party, and that it may be very well for him to wish me to know nothing of the suit and care nothing about it, but that it may not be quite so well for me?"
"Oh, Richard," I remonstrated, "is it possible that you can ever have seen him and heard him? That you can ever have lived under his roof and known him, and can yet breathe, even to me in this solitary place where there is no one to hear us, such unworthy suspicions?"
He reddened deeply, as if his natural generosity felt a pang of reproach. He was silent for a little while before he replied in a subdued voice, "Esther, I am sure you know that I am not a mean fellow, and that I have some sense of suspicion and distrust being poor qualities in one of my years."
"I know it very well," said I. "I am not more sure of anything."
"That's a dear girl," retorted Richard, "and like you, because it gives me comfort. I had need to get some scrap of comfort out of all this business, for it's a bad one at the best, as I have no occasion to tell you."
"I know perfectly," said I. "I know as well, Richard, what shall I say, as well as you do, that such misconstructions are foreign to your nature. And I know as well as you know what so changes it."
"Come, sister, come," said Richard, a little more gaily. "You will be fair with me at all events. If I have the misfortune to be under that influence, so has he. If it has a little twisted me, it may have a little twisted him, too. I don't say that he is not an honourable man, out of all this complication and uncertainty. I'm sure he is. But it taints everybody. You know it taints everybody. You have heard him say so 50 times. Then why should he escape?"
"Because," said I, "his is an uncommon character, and he has resolutely kept himself outside the circle, Richard."
"Oh, because and because," replied Richard in his vivacious way. "I am not sure, my dear girl, but that it may be wise and specious to preserve that outward indifference. It may cause other parties interested to become lax about their interests, and people may die off,
and points may drag themselves out of memory, and many things may smoothly happen that are convenient enough. I was so touched with pity for Richard that I could not reproach him any more, even by a look. I remembered my guardian's gentleness towards his errors, and with what perfect freedom from resentment he had spoken of them. "Esther," Richard resumed, "you are not to suppose that I have come here to make underhanded charges against John Jarndyce. I have only come to justify myself. What I say is, it was all very well, and we got on very well while I was a boy, utterly regardless of this same suit. But as soon as I began to take an interest in it, and to look into it, then it was quite another thing. Then John Jarndyce discovers that Ada and I must break off, and that if I don't amend that very objectionable course, I am not fit for her. Now, Esther, I don't mean to amend that very objectionable course. I will not hold John Jarndyce's favour on those unfair terms of compromise which he has no right to dictate. Whether it pleases him or displeases him, I must maintain my rights and Ada's. I have been thinking about it a good deal, and this is the conclusion I have come to." Poor dear Richard. He had indeed been thinking about it a good deal. His face, his voice, his manner all showed that too plainly. "So I tell him honourably, you are to know I have written to him about all this, that we are at issue, and that we had better be at issue openly than covertly. I thank him for his goodwill and his protection, and he goes his road and I go mine. The fact is, our roads are not the same. Under one of the wills in dispute, I should take much more than he. I don't mean to say that it is the one to be established, but there it is, and it has its chance." "I have not to learn from you, my dear Richard," said I, "of your letter. I had heard of it already without an offended or angry word." "Indeed?" replied Richard, softening. "I am glad," I said, "he was an honourable man, out of all this wretched affair. But I always say that, and have never doubted it. Now, my dear Esther, I know these views of mine appear extremely harsh to you, and will to Ada when you tell her what has passed between us. But if you had gone into the case as I have, if you had only applied yourself to the papers as I did when I was at Kenge's, if you only knew what an accumulation of charges and countercharges, and suspicions and cross-suspicions they involve, you would think me moderate in comparison." "Perhaps so," said I. "But do you think that among those many papers there is much truth and justice, Richard?"
"There is truth and justice somewhere in the case, Esther."
"Or was once, long ago," said I.
"Is. Is. Must be somewhere," pursued Richard impetuously, "and must be brought out. To allow Ada to be made a bribe and hush money of is not the way to bring it out. You say the suit is changing me. John Jarndyce says it changes, has changed, and will change everybody who has any share in it. Then the greater right I have on my side when I resolve to do all I can to bring it to an end."
"All you can, Richard. Do you think that in these many years no others have done all they could? Has the difficulty grown easier because of so many failures?"
"It can't last forever," returned Richard, with a fierceness kindling in him which again presented to me that last sad reminder. "I am young and earnest, and energy and determination have done wonders many a time. Others have only half thrown themselves into it. I devote myself to it. I make it the object of my life."
"Oh, Richard, my dear, so much the worse, so much the worse."
"No, no, no, don't you be afraid for me," he returned affectionately. "You're a dear, good, wise, quiet, blessed girl, but you have your prepossessions. So I come round to John Jarndyce. I tell you, my good Esther, when he and I were on those terms which he found so convenient, we were not on natural terms."
"Are division and animosity your natural terms, Richard?"
"No, I don't say that. I mean that all this business puts us on unnatural terms, with which natural relations are incompatible. See, another reason for urging it on. I may find out, when it's over, that I have been mistaken in John Jarndyce. My head may be clearer when I am free of it, and I may then agree with what you say today."
"Very well.
Then I shall acknowledge it, and make him reparation."
Everything postponed to that imaginary time. Everything held in confusion and indecision until then.
"Now, my best of confidants," said Richard, "I want my cousin Ada to understand that I am not captious, fickle, and wilful about John Jarndyce, but that I have this purpose and reason at my back. I wish to represent myself to her through you, because she has a great esteem and respect for her cousin John, and I know you will soften the course I take, even though you disapprove of it. And, in short,"
said Richard, who had been hesitating through these words. I don't like to represent myself in this litigious, contentious, doubting character to a confiding girl like Ada. I told him that he was more like himself in those latter words than in anything he had said yet. Why, acknowledged Richard, that may be true enough, my love. I rather feel it to be so. But I shall be able to give myself fair play by and by. I shall come all right again, then. Don't you be afraid. I asked him if this were all he wished me to tell Ada. Not quite, said Richard. I am bound not to withhold from her that John Jarndyce answered my letter in his usual manner, addressing me as my dear Rick, trying to argue me out of my opinions, and telling me that they should make no difference in him. All very well, of course, but not altering the case. I also want Ada to know that if I see her seldom just now, I am looking after her interests as well as my own, we two being in the same boat exactly, and that I hope she will not suppose from any flying rumours she may hear that I am at all light-headed or imprudent. On the contrary, I am always looking forward to the termination of the suit, and always planning in that direction. Being of age now, and having taken the step I have taken, I consider myself free from any accountability to John Jarndyce. But Ada being still a ward of the court, I don't yet ask her to renew our engagement. When she is free to act for herself, I shall be myself once more, and we shall both be in very different worldly circumstances, I believe. If you tell her all this, with the advantage of your considerate way, you will do me a very great and a very kind service, my dear Esther, and I shall knock Jarndyce and Jarndyce on the head with greater vigour. Of course, I ask for no secrecy at Bleak House. Richard, said I, you place great confidence in me, but I fear you will not take advice from me. It's impossible that I can on this subject, my dear girl. On any other, readily. As if there were any other in his life. As if his whole career and character were not being dyed one colour. But I may ask you a question, Richard. I think so, said he, laughing. I don't know who may not, if you may not. You say yourself you are not leading a very settled life. How can I, my dear Esther, with nothing settled? Are you in debt again? Why, of course I am, said Richard, astonished at my simplicity. Is it of course? My dear child, certainly. I can't throw myself into an object so completely without expense. You forget, or perhaps you don't know, that under either of the wills Ada and I take something. It's only a question between the larger sum and the smaller. I shall be within the mark, anyway. Bless your heart, my excellent girl, said Richard, quite amused with me. I shall be all right. I shall pull through, my dear. I felt so deeply sensible of the danger in which he stood that I tried, in Ada's name, in my guardian's, in my own, by every fervent means that I could think of, to warn him of it, and to show him some of his mistakes. He received everything I said with patience and gentleness, but it all rebounded from him without taking the least effect. I could not wonder at this after the reception his preoccupied mind had given to my guardian's letter, but I determined to try Ada's influence yet. So when our walk brought us round to the village again, and I went home to breakfast, I prepared Ada for the account I was going to give her, and told her exactly what reason we had to dread that Richard was losing himself and scattering his whole life to the winds. It made her very unhappy, of course, though she had a far, far greater reliance on his correcting his errors than I could have, which was so natural and loving in my dear, and she presently wrote him this little letter. My dear cousin, Esther has told me all you said to her this morning. I write this to repeat most earnestly for myself all that she said to you, and to let you know how sure I am that you will sooner or later find our cousin John a pattern of truth, sincerity, and goodness, when you will deeply, deeply grieve to have done him, without intending it, so much wrong. I do not quite know how to write what I wish to say next, but I trust you will understand it as I mean it. I have some fears, my dearest cousin, that it may be partly for my sake you are now laying up so much unhappiness for yourself, and if for yourself, for me. In case this should be so, or in case you should entertain much thought of me in what you are doing, I most earnestly entreat and beg you to desist. You can do nothing for my sake that will make me half so happy as forever turning your back upon the shadow in which we both were born. Do not be angry with me for saying this. Pray, pray, dear Richard, for my sake, and for your own, and in a natural repugnance for that source of trouble which had its share in making us both orphans when we were very young. Pray, pray, let it go for ever. We have reason to know by this time that there is no good in it, and no hope, that there is nothing to be got from it but sorrow. My dearest cousin, it is needless for me to say that you are quite free, and that it is very likely you may find someone whom you will love much better than your first fancy. I am quite sure, if you will let me say so, that the object of your choice would greatly prefer to follow your fortunes far and wide, however moderate or poor, and see you happy, doing your duty and pursuing your chosen way, than to have the hope of being, or even to be, very rich with you, if such a thing were possible, at the cost of dragging years of procrastination and anxiety, and of your indifference to other aims. You may wonder at my saying this so confidently, with so little knowledge or experience, but I know it for a certainty from my own heart. Ever, my dearest cousin, your most affectionate Ada.